Previously on Beta.
Okay, so why would they fake the moon landing then?
I think you should light the match, Paul.
Hello, everyone. This is Walter Fate, and I'm here once again to talk about neckbeards.
Hi, I'm Doug Gordon. Welcome to Beta from Wisconsin Public Radio. Today, the award-winning journalist Susan Orlean gives us the lowdown on the biggest library fire in American history.
It got so hot that a few of the firefighters said to me that the flame became colorless. It wasn't red, it wasn't orange, it wasn't blue, it was just clear.
Also, we'll explore the internet's culture lab, Reddit.
And he said, what if you build only a page where the most popular headlines and posts from around the internet for that day will live? It'll be the front page of the internet.
Christine Ligorio-Chafkin joins us.
The truth is, I knew it was you. Now, maybe I didn't get the cuffs on you, but I knew.
Oh, people only know what you tell them, Carl.
Well, then tell me this, Barry Allen, Secret Service. How did you know I wouldn't look in your wallet?
The same reason the Yankees always win. Nobody can keep their eyes off the pinstripes.
That's a clip from the 2002 Steven Spielberg movie, Catch Me If You Can. It's based on the true story of the legendary con man, Frank Abagnale. Con men and con women show up a lot in Kevin Young's book, Bunk, The Rise of Hoaxes, Humbug, Plagiarists, Phonies, Post-Facts, and Fake News. Bunk began as a slim meditation about a few hoaxers Kevin has known, but then it morphed into a sprawling blunderbuss of a book that explores the history of the hoax all the way from the 1800s to our present day. So why did Kevin decide to write this book?
It wasn't even so much personal as just I became fascinated by the history of this, and I started to really realize that the hoax had a long history, especially in the U.S., and what did that mean? Is the hoax something particularly American? And I came to understand the ways it was American, which isn't to say that there weren't hoaxes before the United States, but that we perfected it in some way. The idea of the con artist and the con man is an American phrase and idea. And, you know, we sometimes go back and forth whether we admire con men, like in Catch Me If You Can or other sort of movies that glorify that, or if we're, you know, really upset with that. And I think you see that kind of writ large right now in this era where fakery is really at hand. You can see it almost happening live in front of your eyes. And some of the technology we have, from the internet to television to even like now people talking about AI and what AI can do, work on that principle. And I'm not sure we've really wrestled with fully with the ethical and moral questions that that raises.
Yeah.
And those are what really got me going and realizing there was much more to the hoax than simply, you know, fun and games.
Yeah, definitely. You say that race and hoaxes go hand in hand because race is also a fake thing pretending to be real. Can you talk a bit about that?
Yeah, I came to really understand that in the 19th century, where I trace the hoax from and P.T. Barnum, is really when, you know, our ideas, our modern ideas of race and sort of different races and what the particular races are and these kind of hierarchies of race evolved. And that's also the height of the hoax. That's when the hoax really takes off and goes from, you know, something that someone individual might conjure up to something that P.T. Barnum perfected and turned into a kind of not only a show but almost a kind of national treasure and technique. And that kind of combination, I think, is really powerful. And you start to see the ways that Barnum's early hoaxes made use of race, whether it was him showing Joyce Heth, who was, he claimed, George Washington's nursemaid, which would have made her 161 years old, to his other hoaxes where he pretended, you know, that he found the missing link, who he called "What Is It?" question mark. And it turned out to be a black man dressed up in sort of animal costume, but not really. You know, he almost was kind of half-hearted about some of the hoaxes because he didn't have to do it that much because there was this kind of other narrative of race that was filling in the blanks for people. And I think that that narrative is very much with us. And the ways that race is fake are that we know it doesn't have a scientific basis, yet we rely on it. It doesn't mean that, of course, racism isn't real. It's quite the opposite. And I think because race and, say, blackness specifically is, a culture that has created wonderful things that I, you know, think about in other parts of my work and talk about music, writing, et cetera. But also that, you know, race itself is this way that people separate themselves and divide themselves, and they use it often to fake from and with. And that kind of divide that people use is one the hoax goes to all the time. You see people pretend to be Native American, for instance, or take on this other role and play the exotic. And I sort of trace how that comes down to even today.
Yeah, definitely, yeah. As you write in Bunk, Native Americans have long been the subject of hoaxes. There was Buffalo Bill's Wild West shows, which ran in the 1880s and up until 1910s. These shows featured reenactments of Indian attacks. There were also Red Face and people like Nazdij and Gray Owl who pretended that they were Native Americans. How has the relationship between the hoax and Native Americans cemented this idea of the imaginary Indian stereotype?
Well, you see it every Halloween, you know. We just passed Halloween, and you see this kind of parade of people who insist on dressing up in inauthentic ways, like real people. And it's really a puzzling kind of moment. And blackface, you see all these kind of that American history of masquerade that isn't so innocent in these instances. And I think that you see in the hoaxes the ways that it isn't just that people are pretending to be Native, though they are, that is troubling, but also what they also say about that then, you know, and same thing with blackness. It's often that it's a form of extinction, you know, or that it's on the way out, or it's only ridiculous. And, you know, I think that I try to trace it in the book through the centuries, and some of it is realizing that, say, blackface emerges at exactly the same time, almost the same year, 1835, as Joyce Heth, which I think is an interesting and not coincidence. And same thing with when you see the Native American kind of masquerades and red face, as you said. So trying to understand that part of American history, which is complicated, is what I do in the book.
More recently, you talk about a lot of the journalistic hoaxes we've been seeing over the past several years, including Stephen Glass, Jason Blair, and Janet Cook. And you ask the question, why are there all of these imaginary black people in these journalistic hoaxes? And then you rephrase the question as, why are there all of these fantasies about black men who do not actually exist? What do you think the answer is?
Well, those figures are fascinating. You know, and they hoaxed at the Washington Post and the New York Times and the New Republic. So, you know, it's across sort of very prestigious parts of journalism.
Okay, I'm trying to keep cool about all this, but you know the Uniform Computer Security Act and the glass piece? Supposed to be under debate in 21 state legislatures? I just checked all 50. No such act.
Beautiful.
And Julie Farthwork from the Computer Security Center? Not too sure she exists either. Same with Jim Gord of the Center for Interstate Online Investigations.
And I've got nothing on the National Assembly of Hackers or Frank Juliet.
Do you know why this is so great? I mean, do you see the irony here? The New Republic, snobbiest rag in the business, the in-flight magazine of Air Force One, and their star goes out and gets completely snowed by a bunch of hackers. I mean, God couldn't have written this any better.
I think that for me, some of the more troubling is Janet Cook. She won a Pulitzer for her famous story about Jimmy, this young drug addict who didn't exist. But I also try to trace it to other hoaxes where, you know, people invent a black man came and held me up, you know. You know, Susan Smith, who said a black man abducted her children when she had really done it. When Charles Smith had murdered his pregnant wife, I was in Boston. And it was all in the news, and it affected actual black people who got frisked and stopped and harassed, thinking they were suspects. And, you know, picking that kind of suspect, the perfect victim we sometimes hear about. This was like the perfect suspect. And you sort of see that continue. And I was trying to trace that and how that flows into journalistic hoaxes.
Yeah. And the interesting thing about Janet Cook is that she is African-American.
Yeah. She was black. And so was Jason Blair. But, you know, so there was that. I tried to understand the ways that race plays out in the newsroom, but also plays out in our stories about ourselves, which is what I think journalism helps us to do and think about. Why do people believe these stories that when you look back on them are so obviously fake? in the case of Stephen Glass, making up really unbelievable stories. But one of the things that I realized about the hoax is believability is actually not what it's going for. It's going for the outrageous. So mm-hmm. It's so unbelievable, you hardly have time to stop and think.
Yeah, so that question of why do people believe these hoaxes, is it partly in part because they want to believe?
I think so. I mean, I started the book really trying to understand why we deceive each other. And by the end, I really started thinking about why we believe. And why do we believe the worst of each other? Why are things as bad as we fear they are in the hoax?
Yeah. Do you think that the hoax is always political?
Yes.
Yeah.
I think that hoaxes often have elements of power in them. It's, mm-hmm. In the end, it becomes who can hoax.
Yeah.
You know, who's able to say, it doesn't matter. I'm native, isn't really. And I think that freedom to pretend is one of the things that I think you see people resist, say, on Halloween. And they don't want to tie it to sort of white racism. They want to tie blackface to freedom to be something else. And I think that's a really interesting dynamic that we have. But I also, about journalistic hoaxes, I want to really make clear that I think journalism isn't a hoax. I think journalism done right, and I think it's mostly done right, is a way of examining and investigating. It has elements of skepticism in it that are meant to help us and protect us and ask tough questions. And I really want to make clear of that because sometimes people tend to, when they hear of a journalistic hoax, they tend to dismiss an entire genre that I think has provided us some of our greatest freedom and is a really important part of our American fabric of life.
Yeah.
And it's under attack, and I want us to understand the ways that the hoax is a way of attacking it. It's not the state of things.
And speaking of the present, we now find ourselves living in what you call the age of euphemism, and you identify President Donald Trump as the modern version of P.T. Barnum. What does Trump have in common with Barnum?
Well, I think that, I was really trying to I've been writing, as I said, this book for 6 years. Mm-hmm. And then the election happened, and suddenly the idea of fake news took hold in this way that I had been writing about, but didn't know that would be so ubiquitous. And I think what's interesting about the moment now we're in is it isn't just that fake news is something that people are concerned about, but it's an accusation that then invalidates all news. And it's also, instead of saying, like, I'm going to hoax you, I'm going to call you a hoax. That's the ultimate insult right now. And, it goes from everything to, we can't have a national tragedy or a shooting and have a conversation about it without people saying it's all pretend.
Yeah.
That's a really strange place to be in. And we have to be honest about that. That's where we're at. And my book is trying to understand how we got here. Mm-hmm. And think, in the last bits of it, it tries to understand the ways that, say, plagiarism or something like that also is about a larger sign of this cynicism that's cropped up. And I think the cynicism if we think at all about such things, might protect us against fakery, but it actually leads us to believe more fakery because we can't know what's real. We don't trust what's real. And so when we hear a story that's quite good, we tend to hold on to it. It matches what we want, as opposed to the truth, which sometimes can be really tough. Mm-hmm. And I think that's where we need to be, is in those tough conversations and places and admissions. And it can't be that we're denying what actually happened.
Yeah. At the end of your book, you ask a very provocative question in the last paragraph. I'd like to have you read it, if you don't mind.
Sure. What if truth is not an absolute or relative, but a skill, a muscle like memory, that collectively we have neglected so much that we have grown measurably weaker at using it? How might we rebuild it, going from chronic to bionic? The facts are on our side. Let's hope the fictions, once again, will be too.
Thank you. Do you think that we can rebuild our truth muscle and become better able to use it?
I do think so. In a weird way, working on this book has made me hopeful about it. It sort of gives us a sense of at least where we've been, and that sometimes we've been in bad places of fakery, and they tend to be about a lot of different things. I think race is very much part of that, but it's also cyclical, and that up and down quality. I think we're definitely in a down patch or a big patch, depending on how you think of it in terms of fakery. But we're also, you know, that means that maybe there's a chance we can get past that. And for me, when I say that about the fictions being on our side, I think one of the things that is so destructive about the hoax is that the hoax also damages our idea of art, you know, and it does, and the imagination. And it kind of says the imagination isn't worth relying on, and that the imagination, that something pretend can't move us because it has to be true, even if it's, you know, faked and hoaxed. So hoaxers are pretending things are true in order for us to believe them because somehow we can't be moved by the Great Gatsby or someone imagined, you know. Whereas we know from our lives and the power of stories that something made up can move us.
You know? Yeah, very much so.
And, you know, my friend Colson Whitehead's novel, The Underground Railroad, is so powerful because it does take this imaginative leap in what if it's an actual railroad.
Yeah,
and definitely. And I think one of the reasons it's so powerful is it becomes an emblem, a symbol. And that's how art can move us, and it can make us think about our lives in new ways without asking us to believe something that isn't true.
Kevin Young is the author of Bunk, The Rise of Hoaxes, Humbug, Plagiarists, Phonies, Post-Facts, and Fake News. You can find out more about Kevin at WPR.org/beta. No, seriously, you really can.
I thought he meant that they allowed people to smoke in the library. I really had no clue about anything that would be referring to a fire.
New Yorker staff writer Susan Orlean joins us to talk about the devastating Los Angeles library fire of 1986. I'm Doug Gordon. You're listening to Beta on Wisconsin Public Radio. Hi, I'm Doug Gordon. Welcome back to Beta. Susan Orlean is an author and a staff writer for The New Yorker. Her latest book is called The Library Book. It's an intoxicating mixture of true crime, history, biography, and immersion journalism. Her book tells the story of the most devastating library fire in American history. It happened in Los Angeles on April 28, 1986. The fire burned for more than 7 hours and destroyed 400,000 books. Susan found out about this story accidentally while being given a tour of the Los Angeles Central Library.
As we were walking through the building, the gentleman giving me the tour pulled a book off the shelf, took a deep whiff of the book. I didn't really understand what he was doing. And he, after a moment, said, "Well, you can still smell the smoke in some of them." I thought he meant that they allowed people to smoke in the library. I really had no clue about anything that would be referring to a fire.
Yeah.
And he said, no, from the fire, the big fire. And I said, what fire? And yeah, he said, well, the big fire in 1986 that shut the library down for 7 years. I was absolutely astonished that I had never heard about this. And that was a big reason that I was drawn to the story, because I'm very curious about events that seem significant that somehow have missed being noticed.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
It's just, I get very drawn to stories like that, and I was really baffled. I could not believe that I had never heard about this.
Yeah.
And the more I learned about it, the more I was amazed, because I didn't know when he first mentioned it that it was the single biggest library fire in American history, nor did I know that at that point it had been the largest structural fire in Los Angeles.
Mm. So tell me a bit about the fire. What exactly happened?
A fire alarm went off in the morning of a normal work day, and the library was open. There were about 200 patrons inside already and about 200 staff. When the fire alarm went off, nobody was especially concern because they had a lot of false alarms. The building was in bad shape. The fire alarm system was very touchy. So people thought, oh God, here goes another false alarm. They evacuated the building. The fire department showed up, looked around, didn't see a fire, couldn't reset the alarm, thought they better look again, and found a little tiny sort of tendril of smoke in the fiction stacks. Very quickly, it exploded into an enormous fire that ended up reaching 2,500 degrees.
Wow.
It burned for 7.5 hours, just fierce, fierce fire that was burning in the stacks of the library, which are almost like big chimneys that are lined with books. So you can imagine the absolute devastation of this fire. It got so hot that a few of the firefighters said to me that the flame became colorless. It wasn't red, it wasn't orange, it wasn't blue, it was just clear.
Transparent, kind of.
Just,
wow.
And they said it was really terrifying. When it was finally put out after 7.5 hours and just about every single piece of firefighting equipment in the city of L.A., in the ruins, they found 400,000 books were totally destroyed.
Oh dear.
And 700,000 were badly damaged. More than half of the entire contents of the library had been affected. The building was relatively intact. I mean, certainly it was filthy from smoke and lots of concrete crack and spalling and so forth, but the real damage was to the contents. And there was a sense that the library may never recover from it. Mm. Luckily, that proved not to be the case, but it was a struggle.
Yeah. Besides all this structural damage that you just talked about, it did a lot of psychic damage to the people who worked there.
It was really devastating. The librarians were traumatized. Librarians work diligently to build their collections. It's not just that they click on the bestseller list and order those books. They're developing collections that they feel are really interesting and comprehensive and relevant to their patrons. For them, seeing their work up in smoke, literally, because of the fact that they developed these collections, the fact that they had no idea what was going to happen, if the library would ever reopen, their concern about what was going to happen to their patrons, the people who use the library, they were really traumatized.
Yeah. Investigators started to suspect arson, and the prime suspect was this guy named Harry Peak. Can you tell me a bit about him?
Harry Peak was a young man who grew up outside of L.A. with big dreams. He was handsome and charming, and everybody liked him. He was just that kind of guy. He was also a compulsive liar. And he lied about silly things. He lied always just to make his life seem more glamorous than it really was. He decided, like lots of handsome, charming young men, particularly those who live near L.A., that he wanted to be a movie star. He moved to Los Angeles when he was in his early 20s with no plan, except somehow he saw himself becoming a star. It's not clear to me whether he actually thought, okay, there are steps you take for achieving this. He was parking cars. He was working, you know, odd jobs. But somehow imagining that the fairy dust of Hollywood would be sprinkled on him and one day he'd wake up and he'd be a star. And he was always telling his family that he had become good friends with different celebrities.
Burt Reynolds
and Cher. But the thing about him is that he lied about everything, but never in a way to harm anyone. It was innocuous, silly lies, but he was a liar.
Yeah, and even when he was interviewed repeatedly by the police and investigators, he would change his story.
Constantly. Yeah.
I think we can agree that Harry Peak belongs in the Unreliable Narrators Hall of Fame.
He may be the most unreliable narrator. I've never heard of an instance where someone provided so many different alibis.
Exactly, yeah. You decided to burn a book. Why?
For two reasons. One was, I was going to write a description of the library burning, and I realized I had never seen a book burn, and I had no idea how to describe it. But the prevailing reason was I was very curious about our relationship to books and libraries and why they feel almost sacred and why there is such a taboo about not only burning a book, even throwing a book away. I realized that I couldn't remember ever throwing a book away, including books that were literally falling apart. I just found it so uncomfortable, as if it were a living thing. Burning a book seemed like such a taboo that I thought, I'm very curious to see, can I even do this? It almost felt illegal.
Yeah, yeah.
And of course it's not. It's just...
Should be, though.
Yeah, well, should now be. I think it should be.
Yeah, exactly. What book did you decide to burn?
Well, that was a tough one.
Yeah.
And I first thought I could burn a book that I didn't like. And then I thought, no, that seems horrible. It seemed much more kind of harsh. So I thought, well, I'll just burn a book I really like. And then I thought, well, I can't burn a book I like. That would be
even
terrible.
Tougher in a way, yeah.
I thought, well, maybe I'll burn one of my own books.
No,
but I thought, whoa.
Can't do that. No way.
Yeah.
No.
And I also thought that's even not fair because I have lots of copies of my books. I thought also that there's something really weird about the idea of burning my own book.
Yeah.
And I really couldn't decide, so I thought, maybe I can't do this. Maybe I just can't. One day, my husband came home, and he was just grinning ear to ear, and he handed me a copy of Fahrenheit 451 by Ray Bradbury.
Perfect.
And said, here you go.
Yeah. Celsius 232.778, as we call it in my home and native land of Canada.
Oh.
Because we have the metric system.
Is that true?
No.
Is it really?
No. It's funny.
Wow. That's amazing.
Yeah.
And I really did feel that it was the perfect book to burn, and Ray Bradbury would have appreciated it.
Oh, yeah.
And there was also additional resonance because Ray Bradbury spent so much of his life in the L.A. Public Library and loved it so dearly and had been very involved in the huge fundraising effort to replace the books that were damaged in the fire. Ray Bradbury became a bit of a spirit animal for me in the book, partly because of, well, his association with the library itself being so meaningful. In fact, the intersection of the streets in front of the library are now called Ray Bradbury Corner.
Oh, cool. We got to get an Orlean Avenue there down
yeah,
by the library.
That, I know.
That'll come. We'll make that
come
happen.
On.
It'll happen. Just give
Please.
It time. Please. Yeah, so tell me about burning the book. How did it go?
Well, I was very nervous because I was in L.A. and I thought burning anything in L.A. is a very risky undertaking. So I went to my backyard and I took an aluminum cookie sheet, which I thought would be a safe kind of base to burn this book on. I had my husband come out with me with a bunch of buckets of water. I was really nervous.
Oh, yeah.
And I was nervous to do it and uncomfortable doing it and really hesitated to the very last minute and finally lit a match, held it to the very corner of the cover, and it was slow in the beginning. It was just a little trickle of smoke and a little edge of orange, and then suddenly the book literally was gone. It was almost as if it had exploded.
It
burned so fast. Hmm. It was a paperback. But there was nothing left that you would have been able to identify as a book.
Wow.
It burned that quickly.
Wow.
And it gave me a better understanding of how the fire in the library became so fierce. Books are perfect fuel.
Yeah.
And particularly when they're in what is essentially a chimney.
Yeah. How did you feel? What kind of feeling after you burned it?
I was kind of, I felt like I had gone bungee jumping. You know, it was something where I was so nervous and uncomfortable that when I finally did it, it was almost a sense of exhilaration.
You talk about in the book, you came across the Senegalese idiom that when someone dies, their library burns down, and that led you to come up with this idea that the analog of a brain and a library is precise and exact, and you have this great phrase, libraries are our collective brain.
And I really believe that. In fact, I began feeling that even the way a library looks with these rows and rows of books, that it in some way seemed to replicate my sense of a brain as these rows and rows of vignettes and information and knowledge. I've never looked deep inside a human brain, but
there's still time, though. You might do it, yeah.
And yeah, I mean, that could be my next book.
Yeah.
But even the way that a library organizes books in a way that feels almost like the way thought travels. It's not always so immediately obvious how one book relates to the next and the next when you're looking on a bookshelf. Similarly, the way we organize thoughts in our mind. And I really fell deep in the spell of that Senegalese expression because it was both in the particular of watching my mother lose her memories and realizing how we contain these volumes of our lives, knowledge, and experience, and how libraries really do replicate that. It really struck me as being one of the reasons maybe that we feel so deeply connected to libraries.
I think it's fair to say that you have your own distinctive style, which we could call Orleanian or Orleanesque, if you prefer. How would you describe the Orleanian or Orleanesque style?
Ooh, that's a good question. Wow. Well, I like really clean writing. I like to sneak up on people. I like writing that surprises you, that feels comfortable, that feels as if I'm talking to you directly, but that surprises you at regular intervals where you go, oh, wow, or, well, I didn't know that, or, oh, that's a word.
Juddering was a perfect example for me. I love that word you used on page 216, I think, juddering. I think that would be a great title for a horror novel or a movie.
Yeah.
The juddering.
Yeah, actually, yeah. I love that. Yeah. And whether it's a surprise in the pace or the word choice or the information, I like that experience for the reader. I'm very interested in the rhythm of my writing.
Oh, yeah.
And the hope that it moves you in a propulsive way and has these peaks and quiet
an arc,
moments.
Yeah, ups and downs, it does, yeah. And it's very intimate, too. You have this very intimate tone.
Oh, well, that's what I'm very much trying to achieve.
You are achieving it. You're succeeding.
Well, thank you. That's a huge compliment because I would love to feel that I don't have time to come tell you the story of the LA fire, but I'll write it down and it should feel as if I was able to say, sit down, do you have a couple hours? Let me tell you this amazing story.
That's what it feels like. That's what reading your books feels like.
And how that's achieved, I'm not sure, but certainly writing with that in mind as my goal informs the way I write.
Susan Orlean is the author of The Library Book. To this day, we still don't know the actual cause of the Los Angeles Library fire. You can find out more about Susan at wpr.org/beta.
One thing that Reddit learned and kind of taught the rest of the internet over that next decade was that the voice of simply an endorsement from a community member is very valuable.
Up next, journalist Christine Ligorio-Chafkin introduces us to Reddit, the website that calls itself the front page of the internet. I'm Doug Gordon. You're listening to Beta on Wisconsin Public Radio. Hi, I'm Doug Gordon, and this is Beta. Christine Ligorio Chafkin grew up on a sheep farm in rural Wisconsin. Now she lives in New York City and works as a journalist. Christine has covered culture and new technologies for 15 years. She's the author of a book called We Are the Nerds, The Birth and Tumultuous Life of Reddit, the Internet's Culture Laboratory. So let's start with the obvious question. What is Reddit?
Reddit is kind of the sprawling universe of communities online for just about everything under the sun. There are 140,000 of them.
Wow.
And, you know, it's everything from a massive community for women called 2X chromosomes to stop smoking communities. There's humor. There's talk about movies and video games. And every sports team that's ever existed has a subreddit. It's the fifth most popular site on the American internet. And people type into it more than 50,000 words every minute.
So how come we don't hear as much about it as we do about Facebook and Twitter?
It's home to all these beautiful, shiny communities and tons of kind of charities and good-hearted work, but it's also got a dark side to it. You know, Reddit, where Facebook and Twitter don't, Reddit does host pornography and has all sorts of conspiracy theory communities. It's got a lot of political discussion and a lot of ultra-conservative political discussion. So there are dark corners to the site in the way that you might not encounter those sorts of things if you just visit Facebook to look at your friends' stuff or, you know, or Twitter.
Yeah. And the people who use Reddit, it's very user-friendly and because the subreddits that you mentioned, those are posts that are organized by subject into these user-created boards, right, which are kind of like sub-websites within websites.
Exactly. You put that very well. The communities sort of organize themselves. And Reddit's neat because anyone can create any community they want. And that has led to the proliferation of subreddits for just about everything under the sun. So Reddit's not always easy to use, right? It's not always super straightforward.
Yeah.
I do think they've made strides lately in making ways to interact with this site. And so therefore, Reddit of today looks a lot more beautiful. It looks a lot more like Facebook than, say, it did a year ago when it just simply looked like a list of links straight out of 2005.
Yeah, exactly. And can you just talk briefly about upvotes? Because that's what determines how things get posts get promoted to the front page, right? How they make their way up in the hierarchy.
Yeah, absolutely. So basically, any user who comes to the website can upvote or downvote, click up or down on any single post. Now, an upvote is not the same as a Facebook like. It is not endorsing the viewpoint of the content. It's simply saying this is important. So by giving Redditors, the name Reddit calls its users, power to determine what rises up on a page or what sinks down and is buried and other people won't see, it basically democratized the job of, say, editors at a newspaper. That does have so many benefits to the site and a couple of downsides, but one thing that Reddit learned and kind of taught the rest of the internet over that next decade was that the voice of simply an endorsement is from a community member is very valuable. One very funny thing that Redditors will appreciate, I think, is that the original coder of the site, Steve Huffman, also wrote in a little hack to that, which is if a comment got a negative 100 or more downvotes, it would reappear because you know it was just so bad that it might be worth seeing.
Oh,
again.
Yeah. That's funny, yeah. So let's rewind back to 2005. Yeah. Reddit co-founder Steve Huffman and Alexis Ohanian, who you had exclusive access to, they spoke to you exclusively for this book. They have this idea for a business, but the business is not Reddit. What was their business idea?
Oh, gosh, their original business idea was hilarious. It was basically proto-seamless web or any kind of food ordering app that you might use on your phone. But back in 2005, apps did not exist. So they had no way of actually creating a way to get your phone to simply give an order to the restaurant and get that food back to you. They brought their idea to a man named Paul Graham, who had subsequently become very famous for founding Y Combinator, which is the Silicon Valley incubator that is, you know, more exclusive to get into than Harvard nowadays, and is one of the building blocks of sort of modern Silicon Valley as we know it. They pitched it to Paul before he'd, you know, become known for this stuff. He was simply a prolific essayist and a programmer who had founded and sold a company of his own. And he was looking to start an incubator, and he sat down with them and he said, "Guys, your idea for a mobile food startup is terribly misguided. It's way before its time." The company they wanted to found was called My Mobile Menu, which they abbreviated as
Yeah, which is good. That's good.
So he said no to and said, well, let's think of something else that you can do. And he said, what if you build only a page where the most popular headlines and posts from around the internet for that day will live? It'll be the front page of the internet.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And Steve and Alexis said, sure, let's give that a try. And they settled on the name Reddit after, you know, brainstorming a ton of terrible other names. You know, I talked to Paul Graham within the last couple of years for the purpose of the book, and I asked him, well, when did you start to think that Reddit was a good name? And he said, I never have. I still don't like it. I still don't like their alien mascot, which is funny, but shows that he did give them the room to explore, take his idea and run, and certainly they did that.
Yeah. In 2006, just a year after Reddit's founding, Condé Nast Publications acquired Reddit. Condé Nast, of course, owns many magazines like Wired, The New Yorker, Vanity Fair, and GQ. How did Condé Nast's acquisition of Reddit affect the growth and development of the company and Reddit, the website?
Yeah, absolutely. It's a fascinating question and one the book explores at length. It wasn't, you know, it doesn't feel like when you first say it, Condé Nast, you know, it doesn't sound like that should go with Reddit.
No,
Reddit has,
no.
At the time, had its not safe for work community. It had a ton of programmers talking about hacking tips, and it kind of read like a computer science break room at times. But Karosh Karmkani, who had been hired by Condé Nast to acquire some digital properties and kind of breathe some fresh online life into Condé Nast, met with the Reddit founders and thought, wow, this could be perfect. You know, he originally had his eye on sort of more women-friendly publications, but realized that the pairing of Reddit and Wired and Wired.com together could be magic, and with that audience of young men.
Sure.
And, you know, certainly the acquisition itself was great for Reddit. It allowed them to have a little freedom. It allowed them to hire a couple people and gave them the confidence that they could do it. That said, once they were within Condé Nast, they were both insulated from kind of the general market forces and also subject to them in a different way. They were subject to Condé Nast hiring freeze when that happened, when the market downturned. That said, they also sort of had the basic level of funding to just keep going.
Mm-hmm.
They were not, you know, they didn't die in the next dot-com crash at all, and they barely eked by.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. You say that as Reddit grew, its underbelly also gained girth.
Yes,
what do you mean?
I mean that, so Reddit, you know, we were talking about how it was sort of founded as this place where everybody who visits the site gets to be part of the editorial process and determine what content is popular. So one of the sort of taglines that arose out of that was freedom from the press. And Reddit gained the reputation as being a super free speech haven. And therefore, avid Redditors decided constantly that they were going to try to test the limits of what was free speech, you know, what was okay to post, and therefore entire ecosystems of sort of the darkest stuff that you can imagine, you know, photos of highway crashes, very strange pornography sort of emerged in dark corners, and there were sort of epic trolls who curated those corners, and a lot of them had actual, you know, relationships with Reddit community managers. They were just at once testing the limits and, you know, making new limits. They were saying, oh, well, if we repost people's photos of their children from Facebook at, like, dance competitions, it's pointing out to those people that maybe they shouldn't be posting those photos in the first place. When really, to an unaware observer, that those photos put all together looks a lot like something close to child pornography, right? I mean, there were so many odd questions raised during this time that today the answers look a lot more clear to. But at the time, the community manager, Eric Martin, was put in this position where he was just constantly defending Reddit's free speech ethos. But as Reddit became a massive millions of users community, its policies did not evolve with the kind of swiftness that they should have. And therefore, it became a place that was, you know, soon to be featured on Anderson Cooper 360 for a subreddit called Creep Shots.
Yeah. As you say in your book, Reddit was a place where the crowd decided what was deeply interesting. And to avoid that gatekeeper effect, the people operating the site should be hands-off and let the community be self-organizing. So how as more and more dark and questionable offensive content appeared on the site, how did the people who worked worked at Reddit deal with the creation of this content?
Oh, gosh. This was one of the most fascinating areas for me personally to report and to learn about. Community manager sounds like a really friendly job title, doesn't it?
It does, yeah.
And this is actually today one of the jobs. I mean, you know, Facebook says it's hiring 7,000 community managers to police its content. But these people are exposed to horrific images every day. They are the people who, when you get sent a photo that you would not like to see and report it to a social network, those people have to look at that image and say, oh, yep, I got to tell that guy not to send that kind of image anymore. Mm-hmm. And, you know, so that was fascinating. At that time, the job was a very new thing. They did not have, you know, therapy sessions for community managers built into their business model at the time. So as it evolved, these people were actually kind of making the job as they went along. They were reporting suicide attempts to the FBI. They were reporting bomb threats. They were doing their best to kind of help humans help each other. And yet they were subjected to kind of horrible things every day during their job, making it very, very difficult to make those content decisions.
One of the high points in the history of Reddit, to flip the coin and look at the bright side, the positive achievements, was happened in August 29th, 2012, when President Barack Obama participated in one of Reddit's most popular features, AMA, Ask Me Anything. Can you tell
yes.
me about that?
Oh, absolutely. As happens with many celebrities who get on Reddit and do an AMA, which is just a big, it's kind of become a publicity thing. When the president did that, he only got through about 8 questions, but did break news and did interact genuinely. He typed in his answers himself instead of handing over the computer to one of his assistants, as was what was planned. He was just so comfortable using it. He did it himself.
Do you think there are areas of offensive content that Reddit should consider banning?
Yeah, I mean, there's a huge debate right now, and there has been for most of the past 3 years over whether the community r/theDonald should be allowed to exist on Reddit. And this is a fascinating topic of discussion because the Donald is not simply a support community for Donald Trump, which is what it started out as, but the community developed sort of its own language, its own like mimetic style and means of distributing its content far and wide. And, you know, a lot of that involved brigading other communities and harassing other communities and was a very strange community that kind of gamed Reddit in a way that mm-hmm. no other community had before. You know, Reddit itself has had a very strange relationship with this massive Donald Trump supporting community. Most of them don't like its politics. They don't like its style. They don't like its aggressive tactics. But Reddit CEO Steve Huffman does believe that the intent of the First Amendment was to allow for political speech of any sort. And now this discussion has gotten so complex because sometimes hate speech and political speech can be synonymous.
Yeah.
And while he doesn't want hate speech on the site, he wants to allow a community of Trump supporters, you know, he says, well, you know, they elected him into office. Like, we can't pretend they don't exist, right?
Yeah.
When you know, the more liberal Redditors would say, well, they shouldn't even have a voice. They're just posting bunches, you know, nonsense and harassing other people and making it a bad experience on Reddit. When it comes to politics, there's a lot of work that has to be done. I mean, Huffman and the rest of his team has banned the alt-right and many related communities. But when it comes to the Donald, they are still having a hard time.
How do you think Reddit will evolve in the future?
Yeah, well, I think that depends on how users react to its new redesign and how advertisers continue to respond to it. It's a tricky place to advertise when you could ostensibly have your content show up next to something surprising.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
To be on Reddit, you need to be genuine, right? It's mm-hmm. sort of the opposite of the Pinterest and Instagram airbrushed and Photoshopped internet. You know, it's a place where people really connect as humans and talk about things like their financial woes or their relationship woes. They get advice from each other. And that's a strange place to stick in an advertiser, right?
Yeah.
Some brands have had success by simply engaging as themselves. And I think that's a behavior that Reddit really wants to encourage. They want media sites and brands and folks, you know, little shops and entrepreneurs to go on and say, hey, here I am. I'll have a discussion about that thing I make or that thing I did. They want everyone to be doing AMAs and be their real, genuine selves on their site. You know, of course, they would rather have, you know, when Elon Musk sends up a rocket, they'd rather have Elon himself posting a picture straight to Reddit than someone reposting his tweet to Reddit.
Christine Ligorio-Chafkin is the author of We Are the Nerds, The Birth and Tumultuous Life of Reddit, the Internet's Culture Laboratory. You can find out more about Christine at wpr.org/beta. And you can create a subreddit for us. Let us know if you did by sending an email to beta@wpr.org. That does it for this edition of Beta. If you want to hear it again or binge on past episodes, subscribe to the Beta podcast via iTunes or wherever you catch your favorite pods. You can keep up with us during the week online at wpr.org/beta or on Twitter at @WPRBeta. Beta is a production of Wisconsin Public Radio and Red Meat Productions.
Fantastic!
Our technical and music director is Steve Gotcher.
Well, Reddit, it's been swell. I really appreciate your time.
Our executive producer is Adam Friedrich.
The greatest trick the devil ever pulled was convincing the world he didn't exist.
Now, Doug, just thank the alphas and say who you are. Just thank the alphas and say who you are.
God help you if you use voiceover in your work, my friends. God help you. It's flaccid, sloppy writing.
And thanks to you, our alphas. Until next week, I'm Doug Gordon.